Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. This is Carl Shinneman. I'm the Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Jurnov, and here at ESI Bytes, we try to make electronic discovery information accessible to everyone at a price that everyone can afford, which is free when you have time to listen to it, presented by speakers that talk nationally on the topic. And I'm thrilled today to be doing a show with Shannon Capone Kirk from Ropes and Gray on metadata and basically case law that's out there. And just to introduce Shannon, she's at Ropes and Gray, which is an Am Law 100 large law firm headquartered in Boston. She's Ropes and Gray's e-discovery counsel. Her practice is focused on e-discovery law, built upon her complex commercial litigation background with a particular emphasis on mass tort litigation, multi-district litigation, product liability, trade secret, and contract dispute. She's litigated cases all over the country, both in state and federal court, as well as representing a number of Italian-based, Italy-based clients who work in the United States. And Shannon has presented eDiscovery talks all over the country, been on TV on eDiscovery, NBC News, CBS News.
Well, let me correct you there. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I wasn't on NBC and CBS for eDiscovery. I was on it for a popcorn case, and the odor of popcorn.
Popcorn. Okay. Well, I'm sure there were some interesting issues in that one. Maybe a topic for another podcast.
Yes, I think so. It was a very interesting case.
All right. Well, anyway, let's jump into eDiscovery here. And how did you get interested in electronic discovery, first of all?
Yep, I know the exact moment in time. It was about seven years ago. I was sitting
in pre or post popcorn, first of all?
It was pre popcorn.
Okay.
Yes. I was sitting in a deposition of a hospital, a network of hospitals IT manager. And all along, the plaintiff in the case, we were the defendants, the plaintiff in the case had been asking for emails. And 7 years ago, email production and search for email was really not a big thing. You really didn't search for email as you do today. And the plaintiff kept insisting that there were all these emails, and she knew that there were these emails, et cetera. And our IT manager, until the day of her deposition, kept saying, there are none. I don't know what she's talking about. We've given everything that we could possibly have. And we'd gone over it several times. Well, in her deposition, the light bulb came on over her head, and she said, oh, you know what? Actually, now that I think about it, we have 100,000 backup tapes in a warehouse in Mobile, Alabama. And, of course, that just started a lot of commotion in the room, and it caused a lot of work in terms of briefing. So we then entered into a very prolonged briefing on cost shifting. We moved to shift the cost to restore and review those backup tapes to the plaintiff. Our estimate at that time, it would have cost about $1 million. And there really was no likelihood that among those tapes there would be anything that would be responsive. At the time, there was a case out, Roe Entertainment, and that was really the only case touching upon the cost shifting as it related to e-discovery. In the middle of our briefing, because the briefing ended up taking almost a year, through all of the different hearings we had, we were in state court in Illinois, so there was really a low level of sophistication and knowledge on e-discovery at the time in that court. And in the middle of it is when Zubelake came out. So we had to shift our briefs over to the Zubelake elements. And ultimately, I won that round, and the cost was shifted to the plaintiff, and the case ended up settling. So I got hooked. And at the time, I was at a great mid-sized boutique firm, litigation boutique firm in Chicago, Ungaretti and Harris, mm-hmm. and I just sort of became the firm's point person on e-discovery issues. and chaired the e-discovery committee there. And really, I've just it was ever since that moment in that deposition that we learned about backup tapes in a warehouse in Alabama. So it was interesting.
Yeah, no, that is okay. Well, let's talk about metadata a little bit here. First of all, you know, how would you describe metadata to the listeners?
Well, it depends, and I think that maybe we should clarify and have a generally good understanding. When I say metadata, I'm not including embedded data. When I say metadata, I'm talking about the data about the data that you're looking at. So the data that you don't see concerning the document.
Data creation, things like
that. The data creation, the date modified, the author, et cetera, perhaps a file path. But when I'm talking, and so I think that there might be some confusion out there that would also include embedded data, such as hidden comments in a document, track changes, hidden Excel spreadsheet columns or formulas. And I would view the embedded data as, in my view and in my experience, much more substantive or much more likely to lead to something that would be more useful in litigation as opposed to your run-of-the-mill metadata. And so that's why I just want to make sure that we have a distinction there.
Yeah, no, that's important and good clarification. So looking about the stuff about the documents, the metadata, have you actually ever had to use metadata in a case?
You know, there was one time that I did, and it was very useful. We were litigating a misappropriation of trade secret case. And we were trying to prove that the defendants had absconded with certain trade secrets while they were still employed at my client's company. And we really had to nail down dates that certain documents were created and when certain conversations took place. In that instance, then, we had a lot of forensics work going on,
mm-hmm.
but and that forensics information was very useful as well. But for straight-up metadata, there was one document, a business plan, and by simply looking at the metadata and finding the date created and the author of that document, we were able to prove that the defendants had created that document while employed at my client's company, and we were also able to prove that a certain defendant or a potential defendant was involved in the entire transaction, and that was something that, until that time, was very difficult to prove.
Hmm. Now, looking at the federal rules, Rule 34 specifically, does that automatically require a party to preserve and produce metadata?
You know, I think that in my reading of federal case law is now pretty consistent that nothing in Rule 34 expressly requires metadata. And I can walk through a few cases to illustrate that point. The Kentucky Speedway case, Eastern District, Kentucky, December 18, 2006, in that case, the court denied a motion to compel metadata and relied on one well-known commentator, Tom Allman, and said, however, as one commentator has observed, neither default form is intended to mandate production of metadata or embedded data. And the court cites Tom Allman's article at 7 Sedona Conference Journal 31, fall of 2006. The court also cited to Principle 12 of the 2005, not the 2007, Sedona Principles. And I'll get back to that a little later. Principle 12 in the Sedona Principles speaks directly about metadata, but the two versions comparing 2005 and 2007 are very much different. Regardless, the Kentucky Speedway Court cited to the 2005 version in denying the request for metadata and quoted, a party should not be required to produce metadata absent a clear agreement or court order. Another court has been very clear on whether or not Rule 34 expressly requires metadata. That is the Michigan First case out of Eastern District of Michigan, November 16, 2007. That court held, although Rule 34 speaks of data compilations, it does not explicitly reference or require the production of metadata. It also said, most metadata is of limited evidentiary value, and reviewing it can waste litigation resources. And the Michigan First Court cited another case for that proposition, the Wyeth case, which is a District of Delaware case, 2006.
So in order to ensure you're going to get metadata, you're going to need to ask for it, I would guess rather specifically. How would you advise people if they want to get metadata to proceed?
Sure. I'll take that in two parts. I would say that first, I think that it's abundantly clear that courts are now consistently advising litigants that they must be abundantly clear when requesting metadata. In other words, you probably should use the word metadata and probably should spell out exactly what you mean by that and be clear as to what metadata fields you truly are requesting and be clear on whether you want embedded data. And that all comes down to really making your request clear and making sure you're participating in productive and meaningful and cooperative meet and confer conferences. In federal court, that would be required under Rule 26F. I can point you to some cases that would be very clear on the proposition that you must expressly request metadata, and also some case law that is pretty instructive on what requests do not rise to the level of seeking metadata, where litigants thought they were asking for metadata, but the court read those requests and said they were not. And so I can walk through those.
Sure.
The Autotech case, Northern District of Illinois, 2008, there was a motion to compel metadata in that case. But because the party simply did not ask for metadata, the court would not compel it. These were the court's words. Quote, there was no request for metadata here until recently, after production. ADC was the master of its production requests. It must be satisfied with what it asked for. In that case, the court also cited to the 2005 Sedona Principle 12. Notably, I would like to note that the court would have had available to it the 2007 version, which arguably might be more lenient to those parties who did not necessarily spell out that they needed metadata in very clear terms, although that might be an issue of debate. Another court, D'Onofrio District Court for the District of Columbia, this is Judge Fasciola. I really like this opinion for a number of reasons. The court was very clear in this case where the party had not asked for metadata. It was not going to compel it, and the court said, the court will not compel discovery that has not been sought. In another case, the Wyeth case, again, District of Delaware, 2006, the District of Delaware noted that the parties had never agreed that electronic documents were to be produced in any particular format, and that the plaintiff had satisfied its discovery obligations through its production of TIFF files. The court noted the, quote, general presumption against the production of metadata. As for direction on what constitutes a request for metadata, as I said, I believe that the courts, my reading of the case law at least, is that parties need to be abundantly clear on what they want in production, and that would be being abundantly clear and I would say technologically accurate on what exactly they want from metadata. Back to the Autotech case from the Northern District of Illinois, 2008, as I just mentioned, the court denied a motion to compel metadata associated with a certain file. It was an easy touch file by holding that the metadata had never been requested. In holding that metadata had never been requested there, the court compared ADC's request, and here was ADC's request. Quote, each and every document identified in response to interrogatories, end quote. And the court said that is not a request for metadata. The court compared that request to another request in the Hagenbusch case, also out of the Northern District of Illinois, I believe. In that case, the party had requested identical electronic copies of the electronic media. The court said that that request made clear that paper form or an image form was not going to be appropriate. The D'Onofrio case is helpful in that Judge Fasciola walks through what is a standard traditional request for documents, but it's a standard traditional request for documents in the paper world. And Judge Fasciola was very helpful in being realistic and saying that that request cannot translate into an electronic request for metadata. And this was specifically the request at issue. In D'Onofrio, the plaintiff had argued that she had requested the native version of a business plan under Rule 34, and she pointed to her request number 4, which read, any documents that are stored or maintained in files in the normal course of business, such documents shall be produced in such files or in such a manner as to preserve and identify the file from which such documents were taken. Judge Fasciola was not convinced that that was a request for metadata, and he said, the request was not meant to encompass electronic data. Instead, it addresses a common concern of paper discovery, the identification of a document's custodian and origin. I like that illustration because one could read that request that I just read as a request for documents in their native form and therefore all of their metadata. However, we all know that that request is a leftover from the paper days of discovery. And I think that Judge Fasciola's opinion is a decisive nod to the intricacies of technology and the reality and the need to be specific these days on what you are requesting. In a very recent case, in another case along this same line, Classic Star Mayor Lease Litigation, Eastern District of Kentucky, February 2nd, 2009. this is the, by the way, the same court as the Kentucky Speedway Court, but a different magistrate.
Mm-hmm.
Here, the plaintiff had requested all sorts of financial statements and data, and at issue was a motion to compel the reproduction of those documents to include metadata. And of course, the court had to review what the plaintiff had requested in the first place, had they actually addressed format. And this is what the plaintiff's request, this is how the plaintiff's request read. Said, with regard to the format of the requested production, the West Hills plaintiffs requested production of responsive documents as they are kept in the usual course of business or as organized and labeled to correspond with the paragraphs and subparagraphs set forth below. There are many things in the Classic Star case, but one of them is that the court rules that this particular request is not a request, an express request for the native form of production. So I think that reading them, those cases that I've just gone through, the Autotech, D'Onofrio, and Classic Star together, I believe that reading that case law tells us that we must be very clear in document request as to what exact metadata we want.
You know, just thinking this through here, you know, if the meet and confer is supposed to be a fluid, ongoing dialogue that a lot of people seem to believe it should be. You know, at a certain point in time, it might become clear that you want some metadata. Is this just stepping into a minefield if you haven't asked for it up front to say, now I'd like to have it? It seems to me that that sometimes can be an issue if productions have already happened.
Well, it certainly is, as is, I think, abundantly clear from the cases we just read. In most of those cases, there had already been a production in either PDF or TIFF format, and the parties had failed to have a robust or even any meet and confer. Obviously, it's very important to have those conferences early and to get an agreement on not only what you agree about the form of production, but what you don't agree, because it is a problem once production has already made. And, you know, Rule 34 protects a litigant that has already produced documents in a certain format that they need not produce it in another format. And that's obviously assuming that they produced in a reasonably usable form and they did not completely disregard a valid request for metadata in the first instance.
Some of the cases I've looked at seem to also have issues with just using old requests for production, just form requests for production without, you know, anticipating the digital world and totally missing the opportunity because your form document doesn't even know what metadata is. So,
exactly. And I think, Carl, I think that the D'Onofrio case is a perfect example of exactly that.
Yep. And actually, I'll mention one last thing, but this has been very interesting, that Judge Facciola is going to do a second podcast with us on privilege logs on June 16th, I think, at noon is when we decided to do it. So,
well, that's great. I'll listen in on that.
Yeah, they're always very informative and entertaining. Well, this is an interesting area. It's developing, and it's hard for people who haven't done this very often to realize the minefields they're stepping into. So I appreciate your insights. And,
thank you.
You know, I'd also like to mention if for a full library of all podcasts at ESI Bytes, you can go to esibytes.com. And remember to visit ESI Bytes to learn about eDiscovery before ESI and eDiscovery bites you back. Thanks again, and Shannon, we'll look forward to having you on another podcast at another date.
Thanks, Carl.
Take care.
Bye-bye.